The cost of mopping up Ophelia, we look at the economics of storm management. Also, we discuss how the finance bill aims to kill off property industry tax loopholes and the game plan behind Scientology's multi-million Dublin spend. You're very welcome to the Post podcast. I'm Francesca Cumman. You're very welcome to the Post podcast. Later, I'll be talking to Sunday Business Post business correspondent Roisin Burke about Operation Scientology in Dublin. But first, I'd like to welcome all the way from Australia on the line, economist and Sunday Business Post columnist Stephen Kinsella. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, how's it going?
And our political editor, Michael Brennan. Thanks both very much. We're going to talk about a couple of things, but first off, Storm Ophelia. It left a trail of destruction through much of Ireland on Monday. Thousands of homes and businesses are still without water and electricity, mainly in the south, west and southeast of the country. There are early estimates that the costs of the damage will run to somewhere between half a billion and three quarters of a billion. Stephen, I'm going to start with you first. How do insurance companies and the like come up with these preliminary figures, and how much should we rely on them?
Well, these preliminary figures typically come from what are called integrated assessment models. And essentially what they do is they say, if a road gets washed away, how much does it cost to repair? If 10 roofs out of 100 get destroyed, how much does each of those cost to repair? And so they've made a sort of an initial stab at the figure by looking at just how many homes were knocked out and how much electricity was down and that kind of stuff. And once they do that, it's pretty clear to them what their likely risk exposure is. It's probably worth noting that almost every single time there has been an estimate like this, the initial estimate has been off by some amount, typically somewhere between 10 and 100% off.
So lower costs, or higher? Or
much, much higher. The costs typically rise because right now nobody's actually sure of the extent of the damage. So, for example, if you know there are five homes in an estate that are totally flooded out, each of those to repair might cost somewhere between €5,000 and €100,000. It depends on the extent of the damage.
Okay, I mean, we're hearing at the moment, and it's really early days, that Insurance Ireland, they've come out to say that, you know, they can't really say if premiums will rise. Do they typically?
They do. Typically, not only do premium rise, people who had previously had coverage and who experience a flooded home or an adverse weather event sometimes can't get coverage again because they end up getting priced out of the market. And then there's a really interesting dynamic there, because then there are calls for the government to be the insurer of last resort, if you like, which in a certain sense it is. We saw that in Limerick during the flooding in Simon Harris's time, when he was the junior minister in charge of the OPW. He had to rock down there and receive his fair share of abuse for the flooding. And I think the government ended up footing the cost for many of the refits of the council houses that were destroyed in that particular flooding.
So at this early stage, we've been told there is no blacklisting. Michael, presumably the government would be aware that they may have to step in. Have there been any talks? Have you heard any mutterings as to what they expect will be the hit on state finances?
I think we don't have a definitive figure so far, but the standard political response here is to wring the hands about the insurance companies, calling them to pay out people and criticise them for not covering people in risky and flood-prone areas, which is, you know, we've heard that for years. I think one difference in this weather disaster, if you think back to one of the biggest we had in recent years, was the terrible snow and ice back around 2009. You had Taoiseach Brian Cowan in charge. We were approaching a bailout, and the communications back then were terrible. There was no government presence. Noel Dempsey, the Minister of Transport, was in Malta on holidays at the time. That wasn't his fault. But this time, the government had advance warning. Obviously, it was a one-day event rather than something that spanned 3 weeks, but there was a much better communications system there. You had the National Emergency Centre, regular briefings. Transport Minister Shane Ross was out, something you don't always see. You had Leo Varadkar down in Kilcock yesterday with a high-vis vest. So a big effort by government to show they were attentive, that they were on top of this. And largely the opposition response and the government response has been to praise the response of the public service. We haven't had the recriminations over terrible official responses as we did have in 2009, which undermined that government even more.
Presumably trees have to be removed from roads, all that sort of thing, but in some ways they might be a little bit relieved. It could have been a lot worse.
It could have been. The tree removal thing is interesting. Micheál Martin, the Fianna Fáil leader, has called for a tree subsidisation removal scheme, that if old people have dangerous trees beside them, that somebody there should be some sort of grant scheme to allow them to get some money back. And we even had Fine Gael Senator Joe O'Reilly in the Shannon yesterday calling for trees to be taken down off the roadside wherever they could fall on cars. Now, that's a lot of trees in a country like Ireland. So those are sort of things being debated. Leo Varadkar said he'll look at the issue of tree removal, but you know that has come up because unfortunately we have had fatalities in two cases in Waterford and Louth, people dying, their cars being hit by trees or colliding with them.
I suppose, Stephen, there might be seen to be sort of an economist solution, or certainly a debate as to when or to what degree the government should step in, the state should step in when it comes to damages for these type of natural events. After all, budgets are formed to help other people who may not be affected by storm damage. Why should they be bailed out and not someone else? What sort of thinking is there on that?
Well, the thinking is twofold, and really it's the difference between weather and climate. So if we think about weather as what we experience every day, and obviously Storm Darwin and Storm Ophelia were extreme weather events, which, you know, knock power lines down and impose massive costs on individuals, but also the state. And then we think about climate, which is the average, if you like, of weather over 30 years. We know that climate change is a reality, and we know that that has impacts on a small country like us. Global warming means more rain for us, ironically, which means more flooding. And that, of course, means that the government needs to step in really good time, because we know this is happening over a multi-decadal scale, to install good flood plans and make sure that there are levees, and we understand how rivers are going to flood, in order to stop the private cost being incurred, and then stop the insurance companies having to increase premia. That is a planning process that needs to take. It takes years to do it properly, and when it actually does work properly, you never see its effects, because of course you can't claim that as a politician, that the levee that you built, prevented the flood that didn't happen.
It's a very
interesting public policy problem, but it is in that movement from weather to climate that public policy has to take effect. And to be honest, we have historically been very bad in Ireland at long-term planning.
And in this sector, I mean, it does seem to be, I don't know if it's substantive or not, but certainly it's something that Leo Varadkar seems to have been a bit more vocal about since he's taken over as Taoiseach. I think I'm going to leave the storm for there. Obviously, there's a lot of business impacts. I mean, we haven't even sort of looked at the financial repercussions on just all the business hours lost with everyone being shut, or most businesses being shut on Monday, and banks and the like. But just want to look at the finance bill. It's due to be published tomorrow. With that, the Cabinet also, I understand, a meeting today in relation to that, the finance bill, which will then be debated in the Dáil next week. There are a couple of concerns that are going to be raised in the course of this, and a couple of loopholes that they will be looking to close. One is over the new 6% stamp duty rate. Michael, can you just explain what's going on there?
Yeah, certainly. Obviously, whenever the government brings in a tax policy change and decides here to triple the rate of commercial stamp duty from 2% to 6%, there will instantly be a rush to exploit it, to find some way around it before that new change comes in, because a lot of money is at stake. And my colleague Jack Corgan-Jones has been hearing that a lot of people have come up with a wheeze of perhaps placing their land or their office property into a company structure or some other type of financial vehicle, and pretend effectively that therefore this will not be subject to the new tripling of stamp duty. Now, the Department of Finance have said they are going to include provisions in the finance bill to make sure that they can't do that. But we will see some measures, I think, in the bill published tomorrow to tighten up that area so that there is no way around it. And it's very important for the government because I think it's 376 million they want to take in from this tripling of commercial stamp duty. If they don't get their figures right, a lot of the budget falls and they have a big problem. The other area is in regard to farmers, a very emotive issue of family farms. At the moment, you can transfer your land to your son or daughter at 1% commercial stamp duty, is a special lower rate for farmers, but there's an age limit of 67. So if you're a farmer, you get to pension age, the idea is you should hand the land over to your son rather than keeping it in your possession till you're 80 or 90, as has happened many times in Ireland. But these farmers are now facing the prospect of, instead of getting a 1% rate, which was there, or a 2% rate if they went over 67, they'd be paying 6%. So we expect to see some adjustment put in the finance bill so that they will have a transition period of maybe a year, maybe longer, to get their house in order and finally give the land to their son or daughter or an uncle, give it to their niece or nephew without getting hit by the higher stamp duty rate.
So we have like farmers on the one hand maybe being a bit too slow off the mark, and then you have big businesses on the commercial property side being extremely quick off the mark and finding loopholes there. Do you have any idea when it comes to that 6% stamp duty rate on those commercial property transactions, how the government proposes to, you know, stop them using company structures to get around it? Is there anything? I'll actually open that. I mean, maybe Stephen, you might have an idea as well. What might be on the cards?
Yeah, I think what we're going to see there is some kind of registration service where people are going to have to basically put these transactions through some kind of filter, particularly, I mean, you could see with local property transactions, you see it with stamp duty. You may see it here where there must be some kind of registration vehicle to stop that kind of silly buggers behavior. Because of course, you really will, if you incentivize people enough, they will start coming up with interesting ways around it.
Yeah, and it is it's a tripling, so it is it's a big difference, and the government obviously needs to make this work, otherwise it's going to look a bit silly itself. Other matters that have obviously been a big issue, kind of unexpected one really, at all this often happens though with budgets, everything seems to be going very smoothly and then suddenly you have Sean O'Rourke and a woman ringing into the show and before you know it pensions are certainly an issue. Regina Doherty on the radio this morning saying, oh, we're going to look at it. But it all seems to be going forward. So there doesn't seem to be any retrospective relief on the cards for anyone, particularly obviously women who have been affected by the way that pensions have been assessed up till now over a long period, as opposed to just kind of concentrated working periods. And if I'm explaining it well, that seems to have disadvantaged an awful lot. Michael, what do you make of that? There doesn't seem to be any prospect of, I suppose, a kind of relief for women who are affected by this mainly.
Yeah, I think in some ways the women who are in that situation can be grateful that Pascal Dunhuugh gave that interview last week, because he possibly cost him several million euro by using the word bonkers when he described the arrangement, because effectively he's conceded the point now that perhaps the system that was brought in 2012 hasn't worked out fairly for a lot of women in particular. You know, the circumstances such where there was a marriage ban, where women were in jobs in the civil service and in other areas, and they had to give up their job as soon as they got married. That was there till, I think, 1973 or so, which, you know, now does sound bonkers, but they are the people who are retiring and getting a smaller pension. And in a nutshell for people, the system was quite loose up to 2012. You could get pretty much a full contributory state pension with very few contributions because the way the rules were. they tightened up this system. They introduced this averaging where it was worked out over your whole working career, and that has left a lot of losers. I think the government are trying to sort of steady the ship at the moment, say we will look at it without making an expensive pledge. But the last point I'll make is Leo Varadkar acknowledged yesterday that when Fianna Fáil were negotiating the budget with him, this issue wasn't brought up as a budget demand. They now have a motion down in the Dáil tonight demanding the reversal of those 2012 changes, that the cost would be 60 million, which is a lot of money given they have spent it elsewhere. And I'll put it on a wider political level. The budget raised social welfare rates, including pension rates, for €5 for everyone getting a state pension and a social welfare payment. If people really wanted this solved, they could forego their social welfare €5 increase, and that would cover the 60 million five times over. But as we know, everybody thinks about their own
bottom line.
They're
going to be rushing. They're all going to be rushing in to volunteer that. What do you think of it, Stephen? Regina Doherty saying actually this morning as well that the difficulties is that you have to do this, you have to go carefully because any changes you make might have other effects that, you know, will have implications for another group and their pensions. Do you think she's right? Is this going to have to be approached with great caution?
Anything to do with pensions and long-term payments has to be approached with extreme caution. And we should remember that 60 million is 60 million every year. It's not just 60 million this year. So and that can proceed on for many, many years. You can have a
so
situation.
She's right, Stephen, in that anomalies can arise that easily by any sort of tinkering. Yeah,
absolutely. And you wouldn't when you're making a policy change like this, or you know, these things do come up. They come up every single budget in different areas. When you make changes like this, you have to be extremely careful because. So, for example, the 1973 ruling, which was actually brought in by the European Union as it is now, the argument is I would have stayed on, but I had to leave. So it's actually a counterfactual. So you can make if a precedent is allowed to be put on the books that I would have done X, but I did Y. That can be spread very, very quickly to other areas, and the fiscal cost to the state can go up very, very quickly. Now, I actually think these people should be compensated. I think they will be compensated in some form, but they have to be very, very careful. The state's pension bill is due to go up extremely rapidly in the next while. The 2012 pension changes were, by and large, pretty sensible. And anything that limits the exposure of the state to very large pension increases in the mid-2020s is a very good thing. And we saw that with the public sector pension changes, all of which were universally denounced by all public sector unions, which is a pretty good sign. Although I say that as a public sector worker whose lifetime income probably got reduced by it. But still, in terms of the solvency of the system, it's still a very good thing. But the more general point is you don't do this quickly. I think a solution would be found, but they'll have to do that for under 60 million, I think.
Okay, thank you very much, Stephen Kinsella, joining us there from Australia, and to Michael Brennan in studio with me. In today's busy world, the Business Post prides itself in quality independent journalism. We provide trusted comment and analysis on the stories that matter. Our award-winning journalists provide in-depth insights on our 7-day digital offering across a mobile responsive website, apps and e-paper. Subscribe today and gain immediate access to a trusted news source. When I was about 15, myself and a friend were stopped on Middle Abbey Street, and we were asked to do a personality test upstairs in a room, and we went up and we were told that we only use 1% of our brain power, and we started giggling and we didn't do the personality test. The book was that what they were trying to plug was Dianectics, if I'm saying that right. And they were, of course, the Church of Scientology that had approached us, but we didn't know that at the time. We just went away giggling. They've, though, come a long way from a rather shoddy looking room upstairs on Middle Abbey Street. I'm joined in the studio by Roisin Burke, the Sunday Business Post's business correspondent. And now they've got a pretty plush outfit that they just opened last weekend.
Yes, indeed, Francesca. And may I say 1% of your brain power? I think that's highly unlikely. Yes, they've come a long way in Ireland since those days. They first off, exactly a year ago, opened their national affairs office here. So that was a plush office bought for around 4 million on Merrion Square. And now, on Saturday, almost a year to the day, or exactly a year to the day since the launch of the Merrion Square office, they've opened this very large facility in Fir House in Tala. It's been referred to in the press as a European hub. They're describing it as a centre for interaction and partnership and a kind of a community centre. But it's a large facility with a conference centre, with sports pitches that they say will be available to the community, meeting rooms, a cafe. And they're very much emphasising that this will be a benefit to the community.
Was anyone allowed to go to their opening, though? I didn't kind of get that feeling. Obviously, people outside it, but the people who were invited, they were Scientologists, right?
As far as I'm aware, of the 1,200 people attending, there weren't any press there. I don't believe there were any local people in attendance, just Scientologists and their guests on the day. And, of course, their high-profile head of the church, David Miscavige, who flew in especially from the States to launch the centre on the day.
This is the way you've described it. Obviously, first there was the Merrion Square move. Now we have this big 7-acre campus out in South Dublin. Is there any sense of why the Church of Scientology suddenly has Ireland or Dublin in its sights?
Why they're here? Well, they've come under a tremendous amount of pressure or at least negative attention in the States. There have been several documentaries that have portrayed the church in a negative light in recent years. They've been strongly criticised by former members, including Leah Remini. She's a kind of Hollywood star who left the church and has been very critical of it. Also, there have been calls in the States for the Church of Scientology to lose their religious and charitable status there. Now, they don't have that status here, but
that's for tax purposes, is it?
Yes, yeah. Indeed. So, but that threat may have caused the church to look at missions outside of the States. Whatever the reason, they haven't chosen to talk about it, but certainly in the last while, they have opened around 60 new missions all over the world, in Asia, in Europe, in the Middle East. They have said that, and they've a stated ambition in the next 12 months to open many more.
Okay, so, or maybe it's possible that this is just phase two or phase three or whatever of their plan. Is there any sense of how much money they've been spending in Ireland, or is that kind of under wraps?
Well, the centre that they bought out in Fir House, that was sold for in the region of 6 million. Add to that then the Merrion Square office that was acquired for 4 million. Then they've been spending thousands and thousands of euros in the last few months on long leases on lettings for the dozens and dozens of staff that we know have come here in recent months. So it is quite a sizable investment.
Yeah, and staff as well. I mean, when you say the staff, when you say staff, that they're paid, well, that this is kind of idea what they're supposed to be doing, or is this all kind of...
In terms of the remuneration, it's not known, but one of the main objectives here seems to be to carry out the work of what the church calls Ideal Org, which is a kind of a mission that engages with the community, fights what it calls the war on drugs, promotes the church's activities in the
and spreads the community, their
and
word
spreads the world, yeah, exactly, yeah. Spreads the good news.
Okay, yeah. So I suppose it's people be keeping an eye on it, and it's quite an unusual step. I don't know. How many Scientologists there are in Ireland, but I don't think there are that many, are there?
Well, there are At most in the region, it's thought around 90, but many more, as we said, have come here in recent months. But it is a church that has attracted a tremendous controversy, as we said. You know, the church does not believe in psychiatry or psychology as such. They have their own way of treating
celebrity
disorders.
Though. Yeah.
Yes, very, very much so. That's another one of the controversial claims or allegations that have been made in the past, that they have a aggressive way of pursuing financial donations from members. Yes, believes in celebrity. Tom Cruise is said to be a very senior member of the church. John Travolta,
Elizabeth Moss.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, a lot of well-known figures. And well, yeah, I won't get into the ins and outs of that. Their controversial take on the world and as a religion. But I'll leave it at that. Thanks very much, Roisin Burke, for joining us. That's it for this week. You've been listening to The Post podcast, presented by me, Francesca Cumman, and engineered by Jack O'Kennedy. Thanks to all my guests, Stephen Kinsella, Michael Brennan, and Roisin Burke.